Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to another edition of the Talking Metal Podcast, home of all things hard rock and heavy metal. I'm Mark Striegel, host and producer of this show since 2005. Now, let's get things started with the Talking Metal theme song, written by Rob Halford, Metal Mike, and Roy Z.
Hey, thanks for joining us on another edition of the Talking Metal Podcast. My name is Mark Striegel, and today's guest is Greg Renoff, who is going to talk Van Halen with us. And before we get into the episode, I'd just like to remind you to support the podcast by using our Amazon links. You know, when you're doing your Christmas shopping on Amazon, you just take one extra step. Go to talkingmetal.com and use our links to get over to Amazon, and then you go about your purchases as you normally would, and it's still exactly the same price. Everything's exactly the same. We just end up getting a very small kickback on that, but it is helpful. So I appreciate the support you guys have given us by using those links, and please continue to do so. So let's get into the show. Again, we have Greg on the line with me. Greg, how are you?
Hey, Mark. It's good to be back with you again. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming back for what I'm calling the third and final installment, at least for now. Of course, you'll be welcome back sometime in the future. But as far as covering your book, which came out about a month ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Van Halen Rising, How a Southern California Backyard Party Band Saved Heavy Metal. And a lot of interesting stuff that really comes into play in the final parts of the book. I want to pick your brain about Gene Simmons and how he was actually turned on to the band. It sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but some of the girls in the band, the Runaways, may have had a part in helping him hear Van Halen for the first time. Is that a correct statement?
Yeah, and so from what I understand, Gene was living in Los Angeles in the summer fall of 1976. And at some point that during that time period, he had made it a practice to go out to clubs more often, started to check out some bands that were around. And then he sort of mentioned this, it sounds like offhandedly, to Jackie Fox and Lita Ford, that he was thinking about trying to find a band to produce. And Lita and Jackie both had some bands in mind. Lita and Jackie talked about two bands, one called The Boys, which had George Lynch and Mick Brown, later of Dokken, in it, and then Van Halen. And so I think the way that Gene looked at this was that the Beatles had Apple, Zeppelin had Swan Song. We want to have a label like that for Kiss, and we want to have bands just like Zeppelin did and just like the Beatles did that they would have on their own labels. And so that was sort of the vision. And you can see why. I mean, at that point, of course, as we all know, anyone who listens to this knows that Kiss was arguably, certainly the biggest quote unquote hard rock heavy metal band in the world at that time, and arguably maybe the biggest band in the world at that time.
So we're talking, for Kiss fans, of course, this is, you know, Alive, the big album, that their fourth record, which was Kiss Alive, which really kind of broke them to the mainstream, was out for already a year or two at this point, right? Mm-hmm. And we're talking about, it was Rock and Roll Over, I guess, was 76. That was probably out by this point,
too. It was almost just about out, yeah. And so Destroyer was, I guess, was in the cycle too, right? Destroyer was the one that was...
Oh, right. Yeah, of course. Yeah, after Alive. Yeah.
So it was like in between, I think this is in between, correct me if I'm wrong, in between Destroyer and Rock and Roll Over. I think that's right. I hope that's right. So Gene is in Los Angeles, and what is again, on his mind is he wants to produce a band. And so from what I gathered from talking to Jackie, I interviewed Jackie, I didn't speak to Lita, is that whenever Jackie and Lita had some time, they would go over to a hotel called the Sunset Marquee, which is still there in Hollywood. And at the time, it was more of a funky sort of a offbeat hotel. It wasn't like this super luxury hotel, but they would go and they would visit with Gene and Paul. I think Gene was living there. Maybe Paul was too.
Right.
And they would basically drink drinks at the around the pool and talk to them. And, you know, Gene would say, you know, what girls, what bands are hot? And they would always say Van Halen and the Runaways.
And excuse Jackie me, and Lita at this point, I mean, we're talking 17-year-old girls, right?
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, I said the Runaways. They were saying the boys in Van Halen. So turns out that around October, Gene starts to put this plan into action. As far as I understand from talking to Jackie Fox, Paul was much more of a follower in this. I mean, she didn't say that explicitly, but it was definitely was Gene was the one who was motivated to do this, whereas Paul may have been involved in these conversations. He didn't seem particularly motivated to do this. So they, Gene shows up at the a club called Gazzari's.
Spoke about on the last episode.
Yeah, with some people from Casablanca in tow. And actually Paul was there as well. So they show up and they're checking out some bands, and they talk to a couple of the bands and they see this band called The Boys. And it just turned out that night. And again, this is basically the week before Halloween, is my understanding. It's the Wednesday before Halloween or right before Halloween happens. The band The Boys performs. They actually do a Kiss song that night, not because they knew those guys were there, because nobody knew what Gene and Paul looked like without makeup. It was just the fact that so many kids were there that night wearing Kiss makeup because it was a Halloween party at Gazzari's, mm-hmm. that those guys decided to do a Kiss song. So they do this Kiss song. Gene and Paul come up to them, talk to them, of course. At first they're like, we don't believe it's you. They show them a business card from Casablanca, and those guys, their jaws drop, and they say, oh, wow, this is really – this is it. This is Gene and Paul are here. So Gene says to them, when are you playing next? And they say, well, next week we're playing at the Starwood early in the week. I think it was a Monday or Tuesday. And so Gene says, okay, get ready. I'm coming back. Well, it turns out that Van Halen was also on the bill at the Starwood. And so whether that was a happy coincidence or not, whether Gene was planning on going anyway to the Starwood, I was never quite able to figure out. But the way it worked out, Gene was going to go back and see the boys, and then he was also going to see Van Halen for the first time. So when they go to the Starwood that night, the Monday or Tuesday of that following week, what just basically ends up happening is that the boys don't perform very well, and Van Halen really has a good night that gets better as the night goes on. Basically, when Gene walks in, the crowd seems a little bit subdued when Van Halen comes on, but he says that Dave is – Gene in many interviews talked about how Dave really got the crowd going. Eddie was amazing on guitar, and the crowd really got energized, and he said, wow, these guys really have it. Even on a night when the crowd's not really that into it at first, they're really able to get the crowd behind them. And so in contrast, what happened with the boys, according to Michael White, the lead singer I interviewed – of the boys who I interviewed, he was later in a tribute band called The White that did Zeppelin songs in the late 80s, early 90s, arguably the first Zeppelin tribute. He just said we over rehearsed, and basically these guys know that this is their big chance. They just rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed, and Michael White says, my voice was kind of shot. We just had burned ourselves out. We didn't do well. And so end of the night, Gene goes back and talks to Van Halen, and then basically lays this idea on them that he wants to produce them.
So was there any hesitation when Gene lays this on them, or did they just jump all over it? What was the vibe from the band as far as Gene Simmons approaching them with this offer?
Yeah. At first, I think those guys were like anybody else. They were shocked when they realized this really is Gene Simmons, who's there to talk to them.
Right.
And they, I think at first there's this again, this sort of like, well, let's wait and see. And for the future, for me, is what Gene has to say. And basically Gene says, look, I don't want to own your music. I don't want to control you guys. I just want to give you a chance. I think you're a good band. And Gene talks to those guys quite a bit about agents and money. And Michael Anthony in an interview later says that, you know, actually I got I was having a second thoughts about whether I wanted to be a musician after I heard Gene talk for about 10 minutes, because he was telling all these stories about, you know, in some detail about bands that had gotten ripped off. And I think those guys obviously knew those stories, but I think Gene was laying it out in really granular detail, saying, look, if you guys end up with the wrong individuals, you will lose everything. And right. Gene's saying, look, I'm a rich man. I don't want to be richer. I just want to help you guys. And so,
which, judging what happens later with their career after selling millions of records and not having any money, maybe they should have listened a little more closely.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's that aspect of it. And then we should come back to what Gene ends up doing with those guys later in terms of the money. But, and so Gene, at the end of the night, gets those guys to agree to come to a studio called Village Recorder Studio in Los Angeles. I think it's in Santa Monica. The next day, supposedly according to Eddie, literally the next day, to record a demo. And so they do. They show up the next day. They bring their haul their gear over there, or they bring their guitars at least, and they start recording, and they knock out this demo, this 10 song demo, and lay these tracks down.
Right.
What follows next is that. Now Gene thinks he's got a good band, and let's face it.
Did they finish the demo? Because eventually they end up flying to New York, right, to do more recording.
Right. So my way I was able to put it together in the book was that what was happening was that when Gene calls, they work for a day or two, and Gene calls back to New York and tells Bill O'Coin, I found a band. And Bill O'Coin actually says something in effect. He goes, what's the name of the band? And he goes, Van Halen. And Gene wants to tell Bill O'Coin all about Van Halen, and Bill O'Coin cuts him off and goes, I know about this band. I heard about them when I was in Los Angeles last time. And so this kind of getting back to the fact that Van Halen had been around for a while. They had sort of had a reputation as maybe a band that was not ready for prime time, whatever it was. Whatever O'Coin had heard or seen, he had not been impressed. I don't think he actually saw them.
Do you think he really heard about them, or do you think he was just telling maybe Gene that, like, oh yeah, sure, I know about him? Because O'Coin, we had O'Coin on Talking Metal. He's got this kind of like, well, he's dead now, but he had this kind of like, I know more than you vibe. And sure. it was part of his demeanor. Like, no matter what you said, he always wanted to be the dominant one in the conversation or in the room.
Yeah, you know, I think you're bringing up a good point. I took him at face value. I quoted your interview in the book, and I took him on face value. I mean, I think it's a fair point to say, was he BSing? I mean, that's at least what he says he said to Gene. And I mean, I have every reason to believe
that was our interview.
I believe so. Yeah, I believe cool. so. Yeah, I quoted your.
That's awesome.
I have every reason to believe that O'Coin was not enthusiastic about Gene's quote unquote interest in producing a band. And I think it's possible that since other record label people had seen Van Halen around Los Angeles and had passed on them, I talk about that in the book, that it's possible that maybe O'Coin had gotten the word or sort of had been told about this band and just was told, oh, there's nothing there. There's nothing to see. So whether the demo was finished or not, it certainly was not complete in Gene's eyes, because whatever he wanted to do to it, which was overdubbing, quite a bit of overdubbing or more overdubbing than had been done already, he wants to finish. And that's why he takes the band to New York. So I interviewed Michael Anthony. He actually said to me that, you know, Gene said to me and to Alex that, well, you guys really don't have to come because your tracks, we've done the bass and the drums, that those tracks are finished. And I assume most of the guitar was done and most of the vocals were done. But he said, I want you there as a band, presumably because he wants to try to sell a coin or sell the people on Van Halen. So they all go to New York. And that's when you talked about the overdubbing, and that's when really the overdubbing begins. And they go into Electric Lady, they tour the facility. Michael Anthony said that one of the biggest thrills he had at that point as a musician was they go into the tape library at Electric Lady. I mean, he's excited to be recording Electric Lady, but he said that he walked in there and they have all these reels of music lined up and all these Hendrix sessions, like, you know, like Jimi Hendrix. And he said he was just blown away by the presence of all that greatness around him. And, but Gene then, like, basically, you know, maybe has Alex maybe do one, you know, a couple fixes. I don't know. Mike did some singing, but they were done basically very quickly. They were out of there in a couple of hours. And then it was just Eddie and Dave and mostly Eddie and Gene actually just sitting there working on this demo.
Wow. So let's, yeah. So they finished the demo, and I mean, a lot of us have heard the demo. I haven't heard it in a number of years, but on a hard drive somewhere, I have the MP3s. What I remember of it is the overdubbing, which is odd for someone who is very familiar with Van Halen's sound on those first six records, especially there, you know, there was overdubbing. There were times where you'd hear two guitars, but for the most part, it always felt like it was a live sound, and it's a different production on that Gene Simmons demo. And at times, I seem to remember, correct me if I'm wrong, kind of sloppy at times, right?
You know, I think for me, the flaws in the demo are numerous. I always think it's amazing to compare the fact that basically, you know, I don't know the exact days that Eddie and Gene were in the studio, but it was basically early November 1976. They're in Electric Lady. Okay. And then fast forward to February 1977 or so, maybe early March in that area. Then that's when the Van Halen demo is done with Templeman. And so if you listen to the Ted Templeman demo on YouTube and you compare it, it's just...
Is that the ones they called the That's All Folks demo?
There's 25 songs that were done by Templeman. I know we're getting ahead of ourselves, but there's really, they're night and day that compare the two. To me, the big challenge is, like you said, the sloppiness. I don't know if I call it sloppy. I think Roth's singing is not particularly good. I don't think that in a 2-day, 3-day period that Gene had any sort of ability to sort of discern what Roth was skilled at and what he should encourage Roth to do. And so, I mean, one thing I think is pretty evident is that if you listen to a song like House of Pain, there's a couple parts where Roth drops his voice down into this, like, you know, sub-octave thing to clearly an imitation of God of Thunder or something like that. Something that Gene was saying, oh, you'll sound mean if you drop your voice down. And so that sounds forced to me. I don't think the vocal personality that we see that comes through with the recordings that he does with Templeman, meaning Roth and the rest of the guys, the screams, the yelps, the sort of the little laughs, all the little things that Roth sort of made into his own, none of that stuff is really present on the Simmons demo.
Right. So you go into great detail about their time in New York in the book. It includes them going to the Kiss rehearsal, and when O'Coin shows up, I guess the Van Halen guys, you know, get on the instrument. Alex is on Peter Criss's drums. And as a Kiss fan and a Van Halen fan, it's kind of fascinating to think about Ace, you know, Eddie using Ace's amps and Alex playing Peter's drums and all that. So they actually play in front of O'Coin at one of the Kiss rehearsal studios when he's there. Do you know what songs they played in front of O'Coin?
I don't. I know they definitely that Eddie did play through Ace's guitar. Right. Yeah, I mean, they played through their instruments. I think it was, I don't think, based on what Gene says. Gene said that he invited those guys down to watch Kiss rehearse. And probably in the back of his head, he wanted to get those guys on stage in front of O'Coin so he could show them what he saw, show Kiss and maybe show O'Coin what he saw in Los Angeles. And so O'Coin shows up, you know, they're taking a break. And then Gene walks over to those guys and Ted not told them this and said, hey, you know, Bill's here. We should audition. You should do a little showcase. Get up there and play.
Right.
And so those guys were not prepared for that. Now, so they're trying to. You imagine they're trying to set the drums up the right way.
Yeah, and just as a player, I can't imagine like plugging into somebody else's rig and trying to get your sound, and you know, especially drums are such a, you know, the positioning of them and everything. It's sometimes hard to jump onto other people's instruments and sound great.
Well, yeah, I don't think
no matter how great you are.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Gene did them any favors. I mean, I understand that he was trying to give them an opportunity, I think, but in retrospect, yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think it was just you can imagine you're nervous, and then you're up there, and you're in front of, you know, you're like, this is our chance to audition in front of one of the most powerful men in the record industry. I don't have my guitar, I don't have my pedals.
Intimidating town of New York City, you know. So basically, you know, a coin here's, and you, again, we're encouraging everyone to buy the book. It's Van Halen Rising, Greg's book, a great, great read. You can get it on Amazon. We'll have it linked through today's show notes on talkingmetal.com. But basically, you go into great detail in this in the book. But again, basically, a coin sends him home without a deal, right? And he specifically targets Roth, I believe, as the reason why, and basically says it to Roth's face. Listen, I don't think the singing's strong enough, right? Which it has to be. Listen, I mean, I've put out music, I've put out CDs. I mean, that has to be upsetting. I mean, it has to be deeply upsetting to Roth, no matter how strong of an individual he may seem like. That's really gotta hurt. You know what I mean?
No question. I think the other thing too, that's kind of worth just fleshing out here. Yeah, I mean, I'd love people to pick up the book, and I talk about this in even more detail in the book, is that when the rehearsal was over, when the showcase was over, those guys had every reason to believe that something good was going to happen. I mean, even if they didn't play well, because Acoin, you know, based on the interviews that I used of Acoin talking, Acoin told those guys that they sounded okay, or they sounded good, or something like, oh yeah, you guys sound great, and said, come to my office tomorrow. So Michael Anthony told me when they show up in the office, the Madison Avenue office of Acoin's operations, they're sitting there looking at Acoin, and he's not saying anything. And Alex eventually goes, where's the paperwork? Where did we sign?
Right.
And Acoin goes, no, you're not signing anything, you know, and I'm not signing you guys. And just sort of goes, and then, you know, as you said, goes around and kind of like lays out all the faults of the group that he sees, and then targets Roth to basically go, yeah, the singing's not very good. You know, maybe if you had a different vocalist, I could work with you guys, but I can't work with you guys with Dave.
I hate to say this, and I probably shouldn't, because I know Acoin has taken on this legendary status, especially since he's passed, but the guy was kind of a dick. I mean, I've met him twice, and he definitely, just even when you met, like, to me, like, I remember him telling, your hair is not long enough, what are you doing? Yeah, blah, blah, blah. It's like he had a condescending vibe about him, at least to me personally, and I could see that just being part of his personality. I don't know. I really wonder, like, did he hate the band that much? Was he secretly upset that, you know, Gene was spending this time with this band and not devoting it to Kiss, which you kind of hint at the book, in the book, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's all those factors. I mean, that's, you know, that sort of, that is, for number one, I think the thing that's worth pointing out is that Paul has seemingly taken on this interest in trying to claim that he was in on the whole Van Halen thing. And I have to tell you that I really think that's completely revisionist history. There's this.
Well, Paul is the master of revising history for sure.
So even in the book, his own bio, Paul, it suggests that he was one of the guys who helped Scott. Basically, he and Acoin killed the deal. And I have no idea whether that's true or not. You got to take Paul at his word. Acoin's not around to tell us whether that's true or not. It's only Paul's the only guy who can tell us. And that basically, in secret, Paul met with Acoin and told him, you can't let this happen, because Gene will get more distracted from Kiss, because they did have an album coming out and they were getting ready to tour. Then those guys get sent home. They get sent home, and Gene famously says to Acoin as he's exiting the office, something like, you're going to eat these words, saying that these guys are no good, or they're not going to ever get anywhere, and you're going to regret this. And he was right.
Now, I met Gene for the first time in 1995. I may have told this story on Talking Metal before. What basically happened was VH1, where I was like a PA or AP at the time, was interviewing him for a 70s documentary. And it was just, you know, boring questions like, you know, what was Studio 54 like, and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And I was the PA on the thing. And after it was over, they were like, oh, this guy's a big... a big Kiss fan, and it was Paul and Gene, and Paul quickly took a picture with me, shook my hand, and split. And Gene said to me after the interview, and this is just, again, this is right like a week or two before they did Unplugged and they reunited.
Oh, wow.
And he said to me after the interview, he's like, "What are you doing now?" Which I've never had anybody ask me that after an interview. And I said, probably just going back to the office. He's like, "Well, you got a little time to hang out. I want to pick your brain on something." I know it was because I was like, you know, in my early 20s and, you know, dressed like Kurt Cobain or something. And he right. He thought, for whatever reason, and he started asking me, "What do you think of Tool? What do you think of Rage Against the Machine?" He started interviewing me, I swear to God. And we're sitting there, Gene, the producer, myself on the couch. And I just start talking to him then. And I'm like, "Well, what about Eddie Van Halen? There's these rumors that you have tapes of Alex and Eddie backing you up on certain songs." And he was like, "Yeah, I got those. He's like, "I got that. He's like, I got Kurt Cobain singing Going Blind," which I'm not sure is actually correct. He may have, because I know Kurt produced the album that of the Melvins where they covered Going Blind.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So it is possible there's an alternate version where Kurt does leads, although I don't think so. He probably was mixing it up with the Buzz version, mm-hmm. But who knows? Gene claimed he had that. And he claimed he had these tapes of Van Halen backing him up on Kiss songs. I said, "Well, why don't you ever release that?" And he said, "Oh, I'd love to, but the Van Halen guys don't want me to." That's what he told me.
Yeah.
And you go into these songs in your book, and let's first, can you give me a rundown of when this happened? This is after A Coin turned Van Halen down. At some point, Gene approaches at least Alex and Eddie, I think just those two guys, right? And says, come back me up. And Roth, which he speaks about that in his book, this is where his mistrust, I think, of Gene kind of started to creep in. And do you think Gene suddenly turned against Roth after knowing that one of A Coin's reasons for not supporting the group was he didn't like Roth's voice?
Yeah, I mean, let's start with this question, and then we'll go back to the demos. I mean, I think that's possible. I think that's possible. I believe that Gene probably saw the whole package for what it was and thought that Roth was a good front man. I know, that's what he talked about, how he thought Roth was a good front man. And so, but maybe I can imagine if you're sitting and listening to this tape and, you know, you have someone like A Coin who you obviously trust his vision and his, his A&R abilities to be able to say this is a good song or not a good song and this is good or not good. And maybe he's like, "Oh yeah, maybe Roth isn't that good of a singer." I think listening back to the demo, it's hard for me to imagine that anyone was like, you know, "This guy is a great singer." I think if you listen to Van Halen 1, I think there's a lot of ways to go away from that going, "Wow, man, this guy's a kick-ass singer. This guy's good," you know, because of the stuff that the way it's put together on that record. It's just different.
In rock and roll, sure, he's a great singer. It's hard for me. You know, it's like not everyone has this operatic, you know, voice. Look at Mick Jagger. Is Mick Jagger a good singer? No. Is Bob Dylan a good singer? No. Was Johnny Cash a good singer? No. None of these guys were good singers, but they had the attitude and the fact that people couldn't recognize that back in the early days. And I recognize Roth did improve and, you know, his voice got better, but rock and roll is about having the attitude, which unquestionably Roth had tons of that.
And I think the other thing too to think about is, that was a big pressure situation for those guys too. I mean, they're in the studio with Gene, they're recording these songs. I can imagine, like, you know, it's hard to get loose. You know, and that's one of the things that I heard out of Templeman when I was with him in Pasadena, and we had the book signing in Pasadena. He said, "I just wanted Dave to relax. I worked really, really hard to get Dave to relax, be like, let's have some fun, let's get loose." Because he said, you know, anyone gets nervous, and he said that he thought that Dave especially was a guy who, once you got him loose, did a lot better. And I can imagine he just didn't sound like himself.
Right.
The
right.
demo. Yes, and so around April, you're challenging my memory a little bit here, but around April of 1977, Kiss is done with their tour. They get back from Japan. They've done this, you know, they've done this world tour. They get back from Japan,
which would have probably been the rock and roll over tour.
Yeah, exactly. So Gene lands back in L.A., and he had said to the Van Halen boys, "If you get a deal, basically, if you get a deal, great, no worries. And he had torn up the contract. So by the time they get back, by the time Gene gets back, Van Halen has signed to Warner Brothers. So that's nailed down. I mean, they are
really
the,
okay.
Van Halen. So in April 1977, the deal is done. They're on Warner Brothers. But what I think ends up happening is that Gene probably sees Eddie and Alex as useful to him. Number one, to do these demos, but also number two, I can imagine that maybe he thought, hey, you know what, even if they're signed to Warner Brothers, maybe they can write some songs with me. I mean, again, I'm just sort of spitballing here. I never heard anyone say that publicly to say for sure, yes, that's what Gene's interest was in hanging out with those guys. But certainly Roth got increasingly uneasy with the fact that Gene seems to be very interested in Eddie and Alex, not so interested in Dave. And he's worried that he's going to try to steal those guys away in some way. Now, I honestly don't think, number one, that Gene was trying to steal those guys for Kiss. I've said this before.
Well, you don't think that even at that time they could have been eyeing him as Eddie, that is, as somebody who could, knowing how great Eddie was and how revolutionary he was, and obviously Gene recognized that, hey, maybe we get him in Kiss. I mean, do you think that ever crossed Gene's mind? I know it's been spun around where years later, you know, in the Creatures of the Night phase, Gene claims Eddie asked him to join sure. Kiss, which is kind of unbelievable. And I think Eddie has actually denied that. But I wonder, you know?
I it's hard for me to believe that in early 1977, that Gene would be trying to hatch up a plan where he would boot Ace and or Peter from the group.
Right.
If you think about the solo albums are coming out, they've worked so hard to maintain this image of these four different guys.
Yeah, but the whole reason he did this solo record was because, you know, they were threatening to quit the band and they wanted to do their own thing, you know, they being Ace and Peter.
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult for me to imagine
right,
that
you sure,
could actually
sure.
say, like, you know what would be a good idea? Let's kick out the two guys who are as identifiable as we are, arguably, as meaning Gene and Paul, and we'll get these two unknown guys in the band, and we'll pass them off in the same makeup or whatever. So I find that difficult. I mean, is mm-hmm. it possible? I mean, yeah, I guess anything's possible. Maybe he did think about that. I find that hard to swallow. The thing I don't find as hard to swallow is that he thought those guys maybe could be a resource for him, and so hence right, we get these demos that are done. They're done again in Village Recorder. The sessions took place. I quote Rudy Liren in the book. Rudy was Eddie's guitar tech for many years, from like 1974 basically up through 1985 or 86. He worked for Eddie. He was there. He saw it happen. It absolutely happened. They record Got Love for Sale, Tunnel of Love, and Christine 16. So they just record these demos. This is basically Gene's songs that he wants to put on the next record, that he wants to get down in demo form. And right. famously, as we all know, Eddie records Christine 16 and does the solo basically note for note that Ace will copy later on the next record that comes out. Yeah.
Love Gun.
And so thank you.
Then there's this story, which I'm sure you're about to say, but that somebody drops, then you quote them in the book. You'll have to remind me who it is, but that is the solo on Christine 16 still the original one that Eddie played, or did Ace cop it note for note?
So, yeah, in 1984-85, Rudy Liren did an interview with Stephen Rosen, who was, you know, all over guitar world in the 1980s and 90s, a legendary journalist. And he said, he goes, you know, when I heard the Love Gun album and I heard Christine 16, the solo sounded exactly like Eddie. And he was insisting to Stephen Rosen, Rudy was, Eddie's guitar tech, that was the same solo.
Right.
You know, to my ears, it doesn't sound like Eddie playing.
Yeah, mine either. Because after, you know, I went back and I listened to it and it just doesn't. Like, it's a much drier sound. Anything's possible, but yeah.
But so I think the bigger issue here, which we're both nailing down, is that Eddie basically wrote the solo for Ace.
You know,
Ace hears the demo and goes, "Oh, that's good. Let's just do this." The other thing that's worth remarking about as well is that Eddie was struggling a bit with the solo for Christine 16.
Yeah, it's a great story in the book.
Yeah, and so Rudy Rudy talks about how he's sitting there and Gene is, through the talk back, kept saying to Eddie, like, do it like this. I want it simpler. Whatever he wanted, Eddie wasn't doing it. Eddie was getting frustrated and Roth is actually there. So that, Roth shows up uninvited to the studio, supposedly. Supposedly, he was not invited by Gene to come, but he heard that the guys were going and he just shows up. And so, it's supposed to be that very awkward moment where Gene is looking at Dave and Dave is looking at Gene like, oh, okay. So because Dave wanted to keep an eye on his boys. And Dave then says to Gene, hey, Gene, can I go talk to him? And right. He walks in and basically explains to Eddie, this is what Gene wants. And then Eddie cuts the solo just the way Gene wants it cut.
Yeah, that's a great story.
Yeah.
It's awesome. And it shows how, the relationship between Eddie and Dave and how there were certain things that here's this guy Gene Simmons, this outsider who he just couldn't express to Eddie, but Dave was able to get it out of him. So it's cool, definitely a great story, one of many in the Van Halen Rising book by Greg Renoff, available on Amazon, and this is in bookstores now too, right?
Oh yeah, it's in Barnes & Noble, any independent bookstore you go to. Yeah, Half Price Books, all those different places. Yeah.
Now, again, we don't have all night here to talk about everything, but I do want to talk about Ted Templeton and his involvement, and a question that I had in the book that I found kind of confusing I wanted to ask you about. It's Ted. This is after the whole New York thing, after the Gene Simmons thing. Ted gets wind of these guys, I think through was it a Rodney Bingenheimer connection or something?
Marshall Burl,
right. So Marshall Burl, who went on to work with Rat, and was the guy who actually got Milton Berle in the Rat video, his uncle, Milton Berle. So Marshall Burl is working with Van Halen, turns Ted Templeton on to him. And Ted goes down to the clubs to see Van Halen play. And on the night that he's there, I guess he goes one night and it's a poorly attended show, but he's impressed enough to come back the next night, I guess, with some more people in tow, or at least one other guy in tow. So both of these nights that Ted is at the Van Halen show, we're talking like 15, 20 people supposedly in the audience. There were the parties and the shows and out in Pasadena or wherever we're talking thousands of people would show up. I guess I just don't get how you can bring 2,000 people to a show in Pasadena, but you're playing to 15, 20 people at a club, on the strip. Can we say that maybe at this point, Van Halen's popularity post Gene Simmons, post the New York failure and pre the first record, was there popularity fading?
I think, I think you're bringing up a good point. I probably could have done more within the book, but here's what I think actually goes on. And so Van Halen's been playing the Starwood. So the club that Templeman sees them at is called the Starwood Club. It's now torn down. It was a notorious Hollywood club. They premiered there in May of 76. So they've been playing the Starwood for some months, pretty regularly. Now they've also shifted over to the Whiskey at this point, but it's Hollywood. It's a hike from Pasadena. You can imagine that the people hang out in Hollywood have seen Van Halen a number of times. It's the middle of the week. I think your point is well taken, is that they had sort of this, there was probably outside of Pasadena in Hollywood, a sense that Van Halen had kind of peaked. Eddie, from what I understand, from interviews I did, I didn't really talk about this in the book, but was apparently, uncomfortable with letting people know, obviously, that they'd come back from New York and they hadn't have a record deal. So it was this sort of, yeah, we went to New York, we have this tape, but no one wants to talk about the other thing, which is you didn't get the deal. Right. And so, whether or not this was regular dealings for Van Halen at that time in Hollywood, I wouldn't say it was, but I think your point is that Van Halen had sort of hit its peak in Hollywood. In other words, I think people had seen them and kind of like been like, yeah, we know this band and we know their songs. And, not every night of the week was everyone going to kind of caravan from Pasadena down there. And so the other thing to think about is that in early 1977, punk rock is hitting the strip. And so the Sex Pistols have hit big. the Ramones, Blondie, Television, all these groups are big. And so around Hollywood, there's much more of a sense that this is the next big thing, meaning punk rock, new wave or punk rock. And so, you know, Van Halen doesn't fit in that well at all, obviously. No, you know, only the totally confused people at the time would have said they were punk, which some people did actually, which is kind of funny because they were a new group. But so I think that all was factoring into that. So Templeman comes on a lightly attended night, the first night. And he actually doesn't present himself to the band. He says he hung out in the back, he told me, and just watched and was just blown away by Eddie. He said, this guy is incredible. He liked the band, but he loved Eddie. And so what he does the next night is he brings Mo Austin with him. And so he thought strategically about who to bring from Warner Brothers. And Mo was definitely a guy who was, you know, very top of the company there. I think he was the president at that time of the company. But Mo had signed the Kinks. Mo Austin had signed the Kinks. And Mo Austin had also signed Jimi Hendrix. And so he knew that he could sort of get Mo to see this guy's a great guitar player, just like Jimmy is, just like the King, great riffs like the Kinks. And that all worked exactly according to the way Templeman wanted him to. You know, from what Ted explained to me is that, you know, he thinks, you know, Ted at the time was a vice president of Warner Brothers too. So it wasn't like Ted was just some guy, you know, out there. He was obviously an executive at the company, was a house producer. And so from what I gather from Ted, even if Mo hated them, he probably would have given them another chance. He probably would have not walked out and said no. He probably would have given Ted a chance to make the case to him further. But Mo loved them too and said, let's sign these guys. And they signed the letter of intent. You know, they don't actually sign the whole deal, but they go in the Starwood. They sort of say, we're going to sign. And then the next day they sign the letter of intent committing to Warner Brothers. And then the final contracts are done a few weeks later.
Yeah. Well, and there's tons of great stuff about Ted getting them in for the demos and into the studio for the demos. And then, of course, finally the record and how they didn't, there was a long dry spell and Warner Brothers didn't want them playing shows. All this is in the book. Again, Van Halen Rising is the name of the book feature. It's exclusively about the early days of Van Halen up until about, right before the second record, I would say.
Yeah, and so my idea was to sort of climax with the with them becoming, you know, international superstars.
And this book is just a real page turner. You do a great job at keeping the story interesting, which is sometimes difficult with history. But there's you feel the excitement as you're flipping the pages on of the book about, you know, them making it, the disappointments, and the ups and downs. You feel it all. It's definitely a great read. I highly recommend it to everyone.
Thanks.
I would like to, before we wrap things up, talk about the reviews of the first record, which to mm-hmm. me is just one of the greatest rock records ever made. You know, actually, before we go there, though, let's quickly, one other little Ted Templeton thing that I think I've recognized in, you know, he avoided overdubs for the most parts on that first record. Sure, there's a few here and there. I think Jamie's Crying, and there's a handful of overdubs as far as the guitar goes. But he avoided those and tried to keep it a real live sound. The guys had expressed to them, at least Eddie did, the problems they had with overdubbing mm-hmm. with Gene. However, all that aside, part of the Van Halen sound on that first record and potentially the first six records is the Templeton sound. Now, if you listen to Templeman's Doobie Brothers stuff, listen to China Grove, to me, it's not all that different. Listen to that song. Put the headphones on, and the guitar starts off. It's panned to almost the hard right. You know, there are two guitars on that song, China Grove, a song that Ted Templeman produced. But it's got a similar vibe. It doesn't work if you only listening to one speaker, just like Van Halen. You need that stereo thing in order to get the full effect. And even Montrose, a similar thing. Those first two Montrose records, is very similar mixing and panning scenarios going on with those bands. And I mean, the Doobies, obviously a very different band than Van Halen. But again, listen to China Grove. There's some, that song specifically, there's some, it almost sounds like a Van Halen mix on that song. So a lot of this that we hear you got to give a lot of credit to Ted is what I'm saying when it comes to that first record. Don't you agree?
I think if you again, if you compare what Gene did to what Ted did, it's night and day. And I don't say that to knock Gene. I want to be clear that I think any producer, anyone who's tried to do what Gene did is going to struggle probably. You know, he meets these guys and he takes them to the studio the next day. I mean, he didn't have the luxury that Ted had, which was to take weeks and weeks and weeks to do pre-production. Ted told me he used to go down in the basement of Roth's mansion with those guys and spend hours down there going over the songs, going, oh, you should cut this part out, or what about this? This is really cool. Working with those guys to help craft the songs, to streamline them, and to say silly, go, you know, you have 25 songs, but we're not going to record this one, we're going to record this one. And that's not to take anything away from Ted. I just mean that you have a scenario where a guy had time to work and work and work. And yeah, look, the whole, to me, the Templeman, Landy recordings are of those first albums are, you know, touchstones. I mean, I think they're absolutely magnificent. And you can say the same thing about that first Montrose record. I absolutely love that thing. I always say to people, even if you hate Sammy Hagar, if you're a guy that I hate Sammy Hagar, Van Halen, I'm not saying I am like that, but some people, you know, they hate it. Go listen to the first Montrose record. You may not love Sammy with Van Halen, but that's a great kick-ass rock record.
Absolutely.
Rock Candy. I mean, all the way down the line, it's incredible.
Yeah, the first two Montrose records. I mean, I would say just incredible records. And Ted did the second one too, didn't he? Yeah, I think pretty sure he did.
Yeah, he did the second one, right? He didn't do the one after that.
Right.
But you know,
the second one is the one with "I Got the Fire," which Maiden covered, and I mean that second record, "Paper Money," I think it's called. I used to have that on vinyl. I think I still do. Actually, great record. Montrose, great band. So
did Ted really, I mean, I just think that Ted understood Van Halen. He understood, especially that Eddie's guitar playing was the centerpiece of the band. He understood that Roth had his strengths and weaknesses. And I think Ted nailed down what Roth was good at and said, here, we're going to work on this and just, you know, do these things. Don't do the House of Pain low growls. That doesn't sound good. Do this scream or whatever. And kind of got him, you know, to help put that persona together on vinyl.
Now, when the album finally did come out, a few good reviews here and there. The newspaper out of London or the UK, Sounds, liked it. There were, again, a handful of good reviews as far as the first record goes, but mostly, at least from reading your book, it seems like mostly negative reviews when it came to the live performances and the first record around that time. I mean, why is this? Why couldn't the snobby music critics of the time understand how great this was? And when I hear them, you know, lump Van Halen, which to me was doing something uniquely different, you know, that fun California vibe with the heavy hard rock, which could argue was a lot of that was Roth's doing, but they were doing something combining two different things or more than two to many different things, and to just lump them in with like, oh, they're just, you know, doing the same thing as Humble Pie and Black Sabbath. I mean, to me, it's like night and day. They weren't doing the same thing, and how did so many music critics of the day miss that? Was it because they just felt like they were being told that the trends were going other ways with punk rock and they didn't give it a chance, or were they just all idiots?
You know, I think, I mean, yeah, probably that's part of that, but the I think that there was a sense that hard rock and heavy metal had played itself out, and that's what I was trying to get at with the title of the book, was that in terms of the way the common wisdom, if you ask people who were, you know, hip to music at the time, it was like, you know, Black Sabbath is over. Zeppelin, oh, you know, they haven't put out a record since 76 since Presence. What are they doing? They're done. Black Oak Arkansas is a joke. Humble Pie's over. Grand Funk Railroad's over. You go down the line, all these groups, it was a sense that this was over. And so when people saw Van Halen, they saw, meaning a lot of critics, and they saw, oh, the guitar player, like, he's like Ritchie Blackmore. He does the classical thing. He's like Ritchie Blackmore. And, oh, the singer, he looks like Black Oak Arkansas. He's just another Robert Plant wannabe. He's not any good. So they just blew it off. And I don't think they really listened, actually. I think a lot of times, I think they just sort of like, were like, oh, this is just a rehash, instead of, taking it seriously. I mean, even Cream magazine, which is kind of hilarious in retrospect, by the early 80s, of course, Cream is all over Van Halen. But there's this quote in the book that says, from March or May 1978. I mean, right after the Van Halen record comes out, it's, you know, the writer goes, face the fact, kiddos, when it comes to heavy rock and roll, you know, the kind of stuff that sounds like a herd of dinosaurs engaging in some prehistoric S&M, you know, this is what you're going to get, basically implying that these guys are dinosaurs, that this is the last of a dying breed of music. And so I think for all the good reviews, there were some, but I think the kind of majority opinion was, these guys aren't going anywhere. The Sex Pistols, which, by the way, Warner Brothers had released, Nevermind the Bollocks, in November of 77, if I remember correctly. It had just come out in America. And so I think the implication was like, you know what, this stuff is over. What's going to be new and hot is going to be the Sex Pistols.
It's just amazing that through time, how the snobby New York and especially New York, but L.A. music critics too, and London music critics have seemed to be so out of touch with middle America and the common man. And you know, I like the Sex Pistols. Listen, I like the Velvet Underground. I like the Strokes even in more recent times. But these were all the bands that the mm-hmm. critics loved, and they never really caught on, you know. And yet you look at Led Zeppelin and Sabbath and Van Halen, and hell, I hate to include bands like Nickelback or whatever, but they sell a shitload of records. And the critics hate these bands, you know. So it's interesting that went on with Van Halen.
The one thing I tried to do in the chapter on the 78 tour was to I used a lot of newspaper reviews. What was surprising to me was that even at the time when you have a lot of critics bashing the Van Halen record, you had a lot of times. Not always, but a lot of times these critics would go see Van Halen open for Journey, or open for Van Halen open for Black Sabbath, and they would say they put on a good show. These guys are good, because they saw the crowd getting into them. And I think, you know, later years where, of course, the crowds went crazy for Van Halen 81, 82. At that point, you know, in their eyes of the critics, Roth was obnoxious. He was full of himself. You know, it was just sort of this like, Van Halen sucks. A lot of critics thought, the ones who liked Elvis Costello, as Roth famously would say later. But it's interesting, in 78, they were sort of like, they won over a lot of these right. Music critics who went to see them live because they were so great. And look, that's the other thing too that people missed. If you listen to the record, it's one thing. You say, you really got me. They're just rehashing the 60s. You saw Van Halen live in 1978. It was a force of nature. They play the Texas Jam on rented instruments, and they steal the show. And the whole crowd just went crazy for the first band on the stage. They just went absolutely berserk for Van Halen. And this happens over and over and over again, where Van Halen comes on, blows everybody away, and leaves everyone thinking, oh my God, the guitar player, what did he just do? And the singer, and everyone goes home and they say, I just saw this incredible band, Van Halen. And that's why the record sold, right, 2 million copies, is because not only were they had a good record, but they also delivered live, and they played a ton of shows. They toured from March through December of 78. They were on the road a long time.
One other thing I want to touch upon, and we'll wrap it up after this, but, we kind of spoke about this the last time, talking more about videos and film footage that may be, and live recordings that may be in the vaults, but what about all these studio recordings? I mean, through your book, there was stuff that was demoed. I mean, what's that one guy's name? Kim Fowley? I mean, that song he wrote, I listened to that on YouTube after reading about it in your book. That's a great song, and it sounds like it's really well produced, even on the crummy YouTube. There's got to be some great sounding, unreleased stuff in the vaults by Van Halen. It appears to be quite a bit of it. I mean, in any other band, Kiss, Led Zeppelin, you know, they go back and release every little freaking, even Ozzy, you know, with the Randy Rhoads stuff, they go back and release Iron Maiden, everything that they can put out there, they release to make a buck. Why is Van Halen sitting on all this stuff? Does it is it all come back to the issue that they don't want to have to pay Michael Anthony?
I think I have some ideas. Let me start with the first thing, is that I heard recently, all due respect to Eddie Van Halen, I heard him say something to the effect of, oh, well, the demo recording we did for Ted Templeman, again, this is not the album sessions, right? This is the demo that was done earlier in 1977. Right. This is, done in Sunset Sound, whatever it was, 24 track, the whole nine yards. Oh, those tapes are lost. I dare suggest that it's highly, highly unlikely that a corporation like Warner Brothers, which is the obviously one of the great record labels in the history of recorded music has lost, you know, reels that say Van Halen on the side that are lost. I suspect that those guys have their reasons why they don't want that stuff to come out. You know, I think you go down the list, you think about, maybe is it Michael Anthony? Could be. Is it that those guys really truly believe that they only want the record, basically what they put on the albums, to come out, because they haven't even done any bonus tracks? I mean, you and I both know, and anyone listening to this should know, is that you go in the studio, there's always going to be, you know, even if it's like 1 minute and 30 seconds of Eddie playing guitar on a solo that Ted didn't like or something, he's going to say, do it again. Or,
and
you know,
then when they do the reissues, I mean, like, God, Bowie is the master of this. It's like, you know, here's all these bonus tracks. Motley Crue, same thing. You get the bonus tracks on the reissues, and that allows them to, you know, keep making money off of the hardcore fans by releasing these same albums with a few extras here and there. I mean,
I don't fully understand why. Could it be that Van Halen's, you know, just those guys just don't want to go down that road? They don't want to bother with it. In other words, maybe they just don't care enough to release it. I don't know, but I do. I will tell you, I am, you know, I am certain there is material. Whatever, I don't care what anybody says. I am certain there's material sitting in the vault. I'm not saying there's like Zeppelin's, you know, piles of material, but there are in the vault. There's going to be material on those reels that was not used, that could be released. I don't know if it's full songs, it's alternate tracks, alternate vocals. I mean, you could be sure Roth didn't cut every single vocal the first time and nail it. You know, we know that. It's going to be like, do it again, Dave, sing it again. And just, okay, so Dave sings it again, so there's an alternate vocal. You know, even look at 1984. Eddie famously sat up there with Don Landy for months and months and months working on 1984. Where are those tracks?
Yeah.
So this is the stuff, it's I don't understand. I think there is a missed opportunity beyond belief, and I think people would just go crazy for the stuff, and it would just do so much for those guys in terms of catalog sales. Much like, I mean, just would generate more and more excitement around Van Halen. Think about how Jimmy Page rolled it all out. He was brilliant how he did it.
Yeah. Yeah, good stuff, Greg. Thank you, as always, for joining us on this third installment, which coverage of your book and discussion about your book and, of course, the great band Van Halen. Have there been any recent developments as far as future plans? For we know Wolfgang is continuing work on his solo record, but in the last few weeks, or ever since I spoke with you last, you know, the last month, has there been any additional plans for, or hints at what David, Eddie, and Alex might be up to next?
So first thing I would say is, do you find it curious that Dave has not said anything publicly for almost, 8 months now?
Right.
I find that very strange, and I think that's telling about something. I don't know what it is. I'll let people think about what that is. But there, it's very strange that a man who could not get himself away from a microphone ever doesn't talk. So we're not hearing anything from Dave. Wolfie's, from what I've been seeing on Instagram and following on Twitter, he's been sending out pictures of him working in 5150. So I believe that is his quote-unquote solo project, solo band, whatever it's going to be. I don't think we know for sure what it is, but it's not Van Halen music. Wolfie had tweeted out about 6 weeks, 8 weeks ago, or maybe a little bit longer back when the tour was still going, that he couldn't wait to get back to work on his record.
Right.
So I think that's priority number one. I would be shocked if we got news that Van Halen was going to do anything next year, early in the year, or even later in the year. I just don't see it, anything happening. I think those guys have done the tour, and, you know, I think the way it's gone in the past, there's been a couple of years off before something happens again. And so, to me, every year is precious at this point. These guys are not getting any younger. But, you know, the idea about them doing a new record, I don't see that happening, just because they've had opportunities in the past to do a record with Roth, meaning after A Different Kind of Truth came out in 2012 and nothing happened. And so I hope I'm wrong. Believe me, I really do. Obviously, I would love it to be, you know, be proved wrong tomorrow.
I mean, they just, it's like we spoke about this the last time. They need to go out, do a co-headlining thing with a band that has a similar audience base. I mean, there's now this rumor Kiss and Judas Priest are going to do an arena tour together in 2016. I hope it's true. You know, those two bands recognize they need each other. They might not be able to fill arenas all over the country anymore on their own, but together they will be. And I mean, I really think Van Halen could do something like that and be really successful instead of getting these kind of strange choices as openers and stuff like that. They need to suck it up and recognize that their fans also want. I mean, what about Van Halen and the Scorpions? They would probably never do it, but that would be a good build together, you know. Or
listen, I always I've said it before to you, I think, is that can you imagine Van Halen and Kiss? I mean, it'd be the perfect, you know. They could, you know, in a imaginary universe, Eddie and Gene doing interviews together. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
It would be great. I mean, it would be fantastic, you know, and then they could play up the whole rivalry with Roth. I mean, they could get so much mileage out of that, you know, they'll never do that. I don't see it.
Yeah.
I'm sure Gene would do it, but I don't see the Van Halens doing it.
So what other bands do you like, Greg?
I just bought all the second reissues, actually. They are of a long loved favorite of mine. I like Lamb of God, Mastodon, some of the newer stuff. Doors were always a long history with me. I go back, I was into the Doors before I was into Van Halen. When I was a little kid, I got into them. Allman Brothers, and you know, that cool. was yeah.
Excellent. Cool. Well, will there be another Van Halen book at some point, or is that
stay tuned? It's all still to be determined.
Right.
I am just really a couple of quick things. Like, the book got reviewed in Rolling Stone magazine this week.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, that was a very, very big achievement and an amazing and surreal experience for me as a kid who grew up Rolling Stone. Obviously, to have that happen is something you don't expect. And the other thing that just happened, I'll tell you guys, is that Amazon puts together best of list for 2015, and Van Halen Rising was included in their top books in the humor and entertainment category. So there's about 20 books that they chose out of the thousands of books that are like that on Amazon to include. And so that was a big piece of news.
Great. Again, congratulations. Awesome.
So very, very cool for to see that happen. I just really appreciative to everyone who's bought the book and talked about the book. And of course, to you, Mark, for having me on so many times. You've done a yeoman's job having me on three times.
Yeah, man. No, well, I went in earlier today. I said, let's keep this to 40 minutes, but here we are at an hour already. So it's
all good. I love it.
Yeah. It's hard to stop. Love talking about Van Halen and all the bands that we all love. It's so much fun talking metal, talking rock with all the listeners and with guys like you, Greg. So thank you very much.
It's a pleasure always.
We'll have links up in today's show notes to Van Halen Rising. It's a great way to support Greg. It's also a great way to support Talking Metal because we do get a little kickback when you use our Amazon links. So go to the Talking Metal section in the show notes on talkingmetal.com and buy Greg's book using our links. Thanks, guys, for listening. And what should we play here to take us out, Greg?
Oh, let's play Take Your Whiskey Home.
Great. Cool. Talk to you next time.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks a lot, Greg.
Hey, that was great. Thanks a lot, Mark. Well, my baby, she don't want me around. She said she's tired of watching me fall down. She wants a good life and all the best. But I like that bottle better than the rest. And she said, I think that you're headed for a whole lot of trouble. Well, I think that you're headed for a whole lot of trouble. Well, I think that you're headed for a whole lot of trouble. If you take your whiskey. With that liquor in the nighttime, leaves strange memories. Seems a lifetime since yesterday. Come the daybreak, hey, come tomorrow. That woman's waited up all night for me again. Oh, she said, well, I think that you're in for a whole lot of trouble. Yeah, I think that you're in for a whole lot of trouble. Trouble. If you take your
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.